Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang. It is indeed a privilege and honor and, as always, a pleasure to be enjoying this satsang with all of you. And, you know, even as we begin this satsang, we had so many difficulties because we have had a huge power outage from the morning. So we somehow scrambled for power and set it up, and that's why there was also a brief outage in the Thursday live. And even as Prem and me sat, we were thinking that for the first time in the history, possibly we'll be doing a satsang baking in our seats because it's so hot and sultry out here. And dear listeners, can you believe it? Even as we just said, Sai Ram, welcome dear listeners, we heard the beep of the air conditioner coming on, the power is back on, and we are so, so grateful and so thrilled by what has just happened. So, offering our most humble love, gratitude and joy at the lotus feet of Bhagwan, grateful to him for making it back a cool and wonderful place for us to have this satsang. It's so amazing, you know. When we decide to do something good, we may face a lot of obstacles, a lot of difficulties. But if we are determined to go ahead and do it, the Lord makes his entry in the most unexpected and magical ways. And that's what has happened, and that's what has thrilled us. So we will be continuing with our conversations with Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. And last week we had left off at a point where Hislop was asking Swami about medicine and usage of vibhuti in lieu of medicine. And Swami advised him, saying that if one has absolute faith in Swami, then, you know, even vibhuti is not necessary. Swami will take care. But as per one's faith, one can proceed. If you feel that vibhuti alone is enough, it is enough. But Swami said in general cases, Swami recommends a mix of worldly medicine along with prayer to Swami. Swami said, irrespective of what is one's faith or what is one's level of spiritual evolution, sincere yearning and praying to Swami and praying to God is always beneficial. So irrespective of whether we believe in not doing anything and Swami taking care, or we want to take vibhuti, or we want to take medicine and vibhuti, irrespective of what we do, Swami said that you should definitely pray. We had a couple of mails, one from a listener from Canada who shared her experience on how Swami is so practical and understanding as a God, because he knows that there are some points in time when our faith is absolute, our surrender is absolute, but even having surrendered in that manner, again, our mind wavers and we get back into doubting and get back into getting fear. And therefore, she was saying that Swami is so kind enough to give us multiple options wherein you can totally depend on him, or depend on him and the medicine, or just take the medicine, whatever. So she expressed, and we are grateful to her for her thoughts. And that is where we will proceed from. The next question again is not linked to this vibhuti and medicine, but as always, it's very, very interesting, and Swami's answers are always insightful. So that is what we are looking ahead to now. But before we do that, let's welcome Brother Prem. Sai Ram Prem.
Sai Ram Arvind, and Sai Ram to all our listeners. Yes, indeed, it was just at the nick of time we back got our power back. In spite of that, you might hear a few noises here and there, dear listeners, because we still are having a few issues here, but hopefully by Swami's grace we'll be able to continue. And as you rightly said, I think that was the most interesting part of what we covered last time. You know, Swami spoke about vibhuti, and a couple of people made a reference to that. What Swami is going to speak now, the question what Hislop is asking, is based on a question that Swami had answered a while ago on a very important aspect about sadhana. Probably we'll start off straight away with the question that Hislop posed. He asks Swami, he says, Swami says that self-inquiry is three quarters and meditation one quarter. What is skillful self-inquiry? Action can either be skillful or unskillful. As I said, I think there was a very interesting fraction that Swami had given, right? He said 3/7 or something like that Swami had said, where the essence of what Swami was saying there was, as you proceed in your sadhana, after a certain point, there should be more of self-inquiry. than dhyana or japam or things like that. And this is something that Swami has said, other devotees also. So I think the question is based on that. So he says, Swami has said that self-inquiry is important, where three-quarters should become self-inquiry and the remaining must be of the other kind of meditation or sadhana that one does. So what is this, what is skillful self-inquiry? Is the question that he asked. And Swami's answer to that is, the devotee may not have any particular skill, but all can inquire for themselves if what they propose to do is right or wrong. Then Hislop further asks, but are we not to take inquiry as meaning self-knowledge, knowing about what goes on within oneself? Swami replies, self-knowledge certainly is about oneself, not about the outside. Hislop asks, in finding about oneself, Swami advises that we ask if we are the body, the mind or the intellect. And Swami says, you are the witness of all these. Before we further go, I think the refrain in this conversation is, Hislop is asking about self-inquiry. That Swami has said that inquiry is very important. And Swami says that yes, inquiry is important. And the interesting thing that Swami adds is, no skill is required for inquiry. No skill is required for the self-inquiry because it involves only asking oneself what is right and wrong and discriminating in that manner. That is the most important thing. And for that, there is no skill required. And I think in the limited scope of each one's life, I think that question comes over what is right, what is one's duty. Swami is referring to that inquiry, but Hislop is asking Swami, but I thought when you said self-inquiry, it's about who am I? Am I the body? Am I the mind? So Swami is saying that yes, this inquiry is also self-inquiry. I think that is the interaction that happens there.
Absolutely. In fact, I'm reminded of the experience of Professor H.J. Bhagya. Mm-hmm. We have referred to this multiple times. He had a very brilliant career and he was doing well in all the worldly terms. But a point came in his life where he felt extremely dissatisfied and kind of disillusioned with all this. He decided that all of these things in life were not actually giving him peace of mind and joy and fulfillment. And that's why he gave up everything and came to Puttaparthi. You know, like an empty vessel. Swami, you fill me with whatever you want me. I am dedicating my life for spirituality. And he says that when he gave up everything and came, Swami made him take up again a lectureship, and you know, it's almost like I gave up the world and came to you and you're again thrusting the world on me. I will not go into the details of that experience, but when he came here, 1986 was the time when the MBA program had started. In 1987, in Vrindavan, Swami granted him an interview. And in that interview, it was almost like Swami is trying to find out about him. So he asked, so who are you? What are you doing? And he said, Swami, I am so and so. I have got a gold medal in my academics and I have got employed here, all, but I've left all that, Swami. Swami said, no, not all that. I'm not speaking about that. I'm asking you, what sadhana are you doing? You know, Swami came directly to the point. He said, Swami, whatever you tell Swami, I have come for that only. What sadhana do you want me to do? Swami said, find out who I am. He said, Swami, what is there to find out? I know you are the Supreme Parabrahman. I know you are the Lord who has come as an avatar. Swami said, no, I'm telling this as your sadhana, find out who I am. And that is where the interview ended. So Bhagya sir was wondering, what on earth is Swami referring to? Why is Swami saying, find out who he is? You know, he walks out and he was a little confused, but there he accosts Ratanlal uncle, you know, the husband of Mrs. Ratanlal, Ratanlal auntie, who used to be called Ratanlal auntie very fondly by everyone. Ratanlal uncle used to deliver a lot of satsangs and talks to many devotees informally and formally. So somehow Bhagya sir accosted him and Ratanlal uncle just said, do you want to read this book? Then Bhagya sir saw that that book was not from not anything related to Swami directly. So he was not interested. He said, no, I don't think I want to read any book now. I have read enough books for this lifetime. Then Ratanlal uncle said, no, I just feel you should read it. And when he showed the book to him, it was a book by Paul Brunton named Who Am I? And that really thrilled Bhagya sir, you know, because he was saying, oh, who am I? Swami said, find out who am I, and here I am getting a book called Who Am I? That was his introduction to this eternal question that is considered as the basis, fundamental root question. If which is answered, you get fulfillment in life. Swami says that a child is born saying koham, koham, meaning who am I, who am I? When one ends one's life, one should end it with soham, soham, which means I am that, I am divine, with the realization of the divine. So, in that sense, it is very clear that meditation without self-inquiry is of no use at all. It's almost like meditation is the how of doing it. How do I do it? Through meditation. What has to be done is self-inquiry. And self-inquiry without meditation possibly is difficult to do. But meditation without self-inquiry is meaningless, because what are you meditating on? All the things that we do are more or less ways to prepare our mind, body and our intellect to delve into this self-inquiry. And that's why it is said that self-inquiry is three quarters and one quarter is meditation. And Swami also beautifully gives a very practical tip on how do you begin self-inquiry. Swami says, if you find it hard to start off sitting and asking, who am I, or you can start off with discriminating what is right and wrong. Every moment, whatever you do, discriminate whether it is right or wrong and do. That is the beginning point of self-inquiry.
You know, oftentimes, it is said, you know, when you look at the spiritual journey itself, it can be broken up into two portions. And there will be overlap. It is not like you finish this segment and then you go to the other one, or you finish this standard and then you get promoted to the next one. But broadly speaking, it can be spoken of as self-transformation and self-discovery. And the self-discovery part, I think, is what Hislop is talking about, you know, asking who am I, and inquire into the thoughts in the mind and where is it coming from. The other part which Swami speaks of is self-transformation, and Swami speaks enormously about it in his discourses. Because most of us, as we've mentioned many times before, you know, when we come first to Swami, or when we take up to any kind of sadhana, I'm coming and doing seva in the organization, or I come and attend bhajans, or I've started doing suprabhatam in the morning, we always look at it as something that helps us achieve what we're already pursuing in our life. Be it our business, be it education or something like that. But it'll only remain as another addition to the ambitions that you have, or anything that you anything that secures the ambitions that you already have in life. But what Swami says is, you know, along with that, you should also bring in this idea of, what is it? Am I doing the right thing? You know, would Swami approve of this? You're trying to please Swami. And even in the process of trying to please Swami, you'll end up transforming your life. Because you know that if I'm trying to please Swami, I cannot speak this way, I cannot eat these things, I cannot live my life this way. And that self-inquiry is the first part of the inquiry that Swami is speaking about. It is that intellectual inquiry which comes later. In fact, I don't know, I forgot which exactly is that Upanishad which says that all of inquiry starts with first becoming guileless. That you should go out with a childlike innocence.
Innocence, not be cunning.
Without cunning, not wanting to cheat somebody, not wanting to gain in a manner that you know, puts others in inconvenience. So that is the first step of inquiry. So many times and what beautifully Swami says is that is why this inquiry does not exclude anybody. I mean, even for us, even after listening to so many discourses of Swami, sometimes that self-inquiry of the nature that Hislop is talking about doesn't come naturally. But this inquiry of what is right and wrong, nobody is excluded. You could be uneducated, you could be somebody who is, you know, probably in the lowest strata of society. But this inquiry, even you are capable of, and you are also supposed to be doing this inquiry. So I think Swami is making it very clear. I think it's a very important point that Swami is saying, because at that point when Swami said self-inquiry should take up more part of your sadhana, it felt like, oh, I have to start thinking about the self now.
Who am I?
Right? Swami is saying that first self-inquiry is what is right and wrong. What am I supposed to do at this point?
See, I'm reminded during our MBA days, we had a nice exercise, interesting exercise, wherein depending on the kind of game that you like to play, they were saying, these are your strengths and these are your weaknesses. For instance, if you love running or jogging, something which I absolutely hate, If you love running or jogging, you're supposed to be good on discipline. You're a very disciplined person. So, each one of us, depending on the games we love, we got to know the traits, and it was very interesting and it was revealing, because I found that most of the things I found out about me were pretty true. Then came the interesting part where they said that the reverse also works. Meaning, if you find that you're lacking discipline in your life, I'm remembering this because that is what I felt. If you feel you're lacking discipline in your life, take up jogging. Take up jogging and running and do it continuously, and discipline will come in your life. Now, I found this approach even in, once we had an expert handwriting analyzer. You know, he was analyzing our handwriting and saying what are our traits. Similar, so if you have a slant, if it is straight, it means something. If it is small, it means something. If it's fat, it's your letters. If they're fat, it means something. He too said that the reverse works, wherein if there is a particular trait or quality you wish to develop in you, start writing in that manner and it will come into you. And I felt that here it's also like that. You know, we start off by saying, who am I? And if I want to start off and realize that the one in me is the one whom I think I am is the same as everyone around, and therefore loving others, doing right to others. See, when I realize I don't allow my hand to do injustice to my leg, because I feel hand is also me, leg is also me. So the idea is, when I realize the unity of everything, I will automatically not cheat somebody because right. I feel that he is part of me. But the reverse also works. If I abstain from cheating another person, if I consciously make efforts to love everyone, try to see Swami in everyone, this inquiry also automatically comes in. So, either way it reinforces. I may find it very difficult to sit for 24 hours a day and keep reminding myself, I am God, I am God, I am God. At the same time, I may feel a kind of meaninglessness in only doing activities. So, it's a kind of each one reinforcing the other. I do activities, I make efforts to be loving, I do seva, I do bhajan. At the same time, I come and do inquiry. The inquiry improves my bhajan and seva. The bhajan and seva improves my inquiry.
And even if, going back to that example that you're giving of Bhagya, sir, it was again devotion which was leading him on to that inquiry. You know, you're going to Swami and you're asking Swami, what do you want me to do? The very fact that you give up a lucrative career, you come here and you're ready to live in the ashram, do whatever Swami says, is your, you know, your entire life is driven by that bhakti or the devotion that you have. And for Swami's part, he is directing your path towards what is suitable for you. In the case of Bhagya, sir, it was, you know, going into that kind of inquiry. So automatically, all of this is synthesized in that manner. There's nothing like, you are free from inquiry, or you're free from bhakti, or you don't have to do bhajan in that manner. So I think, and one thing that you can see from the conversation Hislop is having with Swami, you can make out how Swami is in a lot of ways bringing him closer to bhakti and love for God, and the importance of that is being reinforced. Because I think Hislop, as a sadhaka, does not have to be told as much about self-inquiry as probably you and me have to be told.
Correct, because that has been his path, all his life. Then Hislop says the next thing. He says, Swami, one notices other things. Every desire announces itself as I, even though exactly contradicted by past and future desires. And it's a very interesting point here. At a point in time, I get a desire. I feel that, Swami, if I get married to this person of my choice, I think my life is done. Swami, if I get this, this is my dream job. Swami, this is my dream vacation. We get this desire. We feel that attaining that, that's it. I'll be happy. And there are many occasions when we attain it. We marry the person of our choice, or we get to go on the vacation that we want, or we get the dream job that we are thinking of. But after that, few hours after that, or few days after that, few weeks after that, if we are asked, are you happy? No, I am not happy because I have a future desire. That is what Hislop is referring to. How can this be true if I am thinking that getting this will make me happy, but having got it, I am desiring something else to make me happy? So he's saying, Swami, though each desire announces itself as I, it is contradicted by past and future, because it's like, if you said you will be happy getting this, why are you not happy? Who is that I then? Who is this I then? You're telling I want this. No, actually now I want to get a child, then I'm happy. But you said you are happy if you get married. who is this I who is wanting a child? Who was that I that wanted to get married? So he's saying, Swami, it's contradicting, because that is what we notice in day-to-day life. And Swami says, really there are two I's. One is the ego, which is always identifying itself as I. The other I is the eternal witness, which is Swami. If there is awareness of the witness, which is Swami, the ego I will not bother. It does not much matter. So Swami makes it very clear that the desiring I is not the real I, that is the ego. The true I is the one that witnesses. So the witnessing I is the I, while the desiring I is the ego.
Right, and this is classic what Swami would say about the Mundaka Upanishad, that famous analogy of the two birds. Swami would say there's one bird in the higher branch and one bird in the lower branch. And Swami would say the whole tree represents the body. The bird on the higher branch does not eat the fruit. The one on the lower branch is actually hopping from one branch to the other in search of sweet fruits. And sometimes it eats a bitter fruit and it is, its face contorts. Mm. Then it eats a sweeter fruit and then it wants to eat more sweet fruits. And Swami says the bird on the higher branch is only looking at this lower bird. So Swami would say that is the relationship between the witness eye and the ego eye. The ego eye is running after all the pleasures and power and victories and is disturbed by the sadness. But the upper one is just looking, and at some point, the Upanishad says that this lower bird will look up.
Mm-hmm.
And will be, first of all, struck by the sameness of the two birds.
Mm.
And then it will start hopping closer and closer to the higher bird. And finally it reaches the highest branch and it becomes one with the witness. So in one sentence, Swami says that whole point. Mm. And again, that question itself shows the level of Islap as a sadhaka, because he is able to observe his thoughts, observe his feelings. And I think later Swami also mentions how that is not a very common trait, and that needs to be taught to people and devotees who come to centers.
Exactly. Hislop then asks, in self-inquiry, Swami, a person may notice that while his idea is that he is a free agent, yet in fact he is pushed around and made to act by all sorts of influences. Actually, one is not free at all. He is like a prisoner, is he not? And Swami replies, that you are not free is wrong. Only up to a certain stage in one's life, according to the influences that bear upon him, such as heredity, circumstances, tendencies and so on. Later on, one is superior to and free from influences. So Swami, it's almost like you cannot say to err is human. No, you cannot take license and say that, see, I am controlled by my destiny, I am controlled by my karma. So whatever I am doing, that's why I hit you, that's why I did this heinous crime. So I am helpless, I am not free. Swami says, in the beginning those influences act on you. But you definitely, that is where the role of self-effort comes in. You have the ability to put in the effort to ensure that you are not completely overpowered or overwhelmed by that, so that you cannot give an excuse. That is what Swami makes it very clear. And if we think of it, Prem, what we say as karma. What is karma? My karma is nothing but the sum total of all the actions I have done in the past. So actually the thing that I say as destiny, if it's like a cloth, that cloth is made up of threads which are my individual actions. So the same threads that have made the cloth, if you pull out those threads, the cloth will vanish. That's why Swami is saying that yes, it has a bearing on you, but you also must realize that it is a sum total of all your own actions. So your own actions have trapped you, so your own actions also will liberate you. So it might definitely take time, but it doesn't mean that it is not possible that you have to give up.
Right, and again, this is one of the classic dialogues that happens between Lord Krishna and Arjuna, and you know, it is always connected to the other dialogue which happens with Duryodhana and Krishna, where Duryodhana says that typically like this, he says that somebody is dictating my actions and I have no control over it.
So janami dharmam,
right, nachame pravritti, janami adharmam, nachame nivritti, kenapi devena hridi sthitena tata niyuktosmi tata karomi, he says.
Translate please, right, for our listeners and me.
So he says, I know what is dharma, but I don't have any inclination towards it. I know what is adharma, but I'm not able to refrain from it. He says, kenapi devena hridi sthitena. It looks like there is a master in my within me. He dictates and I do.
I'm helpless,
says,
basically.
Yeah, I'm just following whatever is being said. So that is that state of helplessness. And Hislop is mentioning that. He's saying, looks like we are bound and something is dictating. And in fact, it is not Arjuna who says this. Krishna who says this in the Gita. At one point, after giving Arjuna lessons about self-control and all that, finally Krishna says, but what can you do with self-control? Anyway, you will only act according to your pravritti, he says. Prakriti. There's a nature which is within you that dictates, and that's what you do. But then Krishna goes on to explain, but there is always an opportunity to go against your prakriti. Suppose your vasana is to do something wrong. The beautiful thing is, every time you resist it, that resistance becomes a part of your vasana. And that's where the whole conversation starts about the...
You build a virtuous cycle.
Right. About the the discrimination which Swami started off by speaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is a... You're in a conversation with somebody and there is this urge to probably, vent out your temper. But at that moment when you resist, you say that, no, this is not the right thing to say, or no, it's not right for me to get angry. That resistance now becomes a part of that vasana. But as you said, it is
part
not
of your nature.
Part of your nature. And that becomes a sanskara, as Swami would say. Vasana is the negative influence, sanskara is the positive influence. And that will not happen overnight, as Swami is saying, because the vasana is built over many, many lifetimes.
In fact, Swami would give the example of a ceiling fan.
Right.
Swami would say that you want to stop the fan, you put off the switch, it doesn't instantly stop.
Right.
That's because of the momentum. You know, speaking of momentum, I think in our life, we carry the momentum of our past karmas. It's like one massive ship in the ocean. When the ship notices that it's going in the wrong direction, you would have seen videos also, I have even seen live, the captain of the ship takes the, what do you call that steering, that wheel.
Right.
And he turns it like one... like a tire frame, like, you know, he's just, well, it's not like a car steering where you turn,
no power steering,
where you turn it just a little bit. He just keeps rotating it to the left and it does about 10-15 revolutions. But the ship is hardly turning. You know, finally, if it's a huge ship, the ship will travel another 1 to 2 kilometers before actually making an about turn. That's the reason a ship just cannot turn around about like a motorboat. But I think that example shows why we often get discouraged. I see that, hey, this is bad in me. I am having this karma. I have desire. I have krodha. I have anger. I have lust. I have jealousy. I want to overcome it. And I put an effort in overcoming it. And I fail in it. And I say, oh God, I don't think I can give it up. It's like that ship captain saying, I turned the wheel 10 times. The ship has hardly budged. I'll give up. No. Keep turning it. Because like you said, we might not notice, but the ship is actually turning. I might not notice, but actually I'm overcoming my karma. I'm actually overcoming my krodha. Like you said, it is silently becoming a part of my sanskara, part of my, nature.
Right.
Okay. I'm not realizing it. And just because I don't realize it, I feel it's not happening. So I think the key here is about saburi, that persistence, perseverance. We need to keep persevering and putting efforts. And finally, we'll see the results like, oh my God, the ship has already turned. Yes. How did it happen? Through the same little efforts which added up.
Right. And I think what Swami mentioned here, you should not think that you're bound. You should think, it is the case, but you don't resign to that fate. And Swami would say that was the difference between Arjuna and Duryodhana. Duryodhana said, don't try to transform me. I am what I am. But Arjuna said that, I want to listen to what you're telling me, but there is something that is pulling me back. Tell me how to get over that. And that was the main difference between the two. And Swami is saying that as a sadhaka, you must feel that there is an opportunity and there is a possibility for you to resist this nature. And that should always be kept in mind.
And that's a powerful example, because if you look at it now, both were superheroes, both were helpless. Just that willingness that I will listen and I will make effort, I will trust. That made Arjuna... they say Yatra Yogishwara Krishna Yatra Partho Dhanurdhara. Where Krishna and Arjuna are there's always victory. And Duryodhana is, you know, we know how he is forgotten, and nobody wants to be even a little bit like Duryodhana. Though in physical, mental, intellectual and all other prowesses, both are the same. So this highlights the importance of that willingness to change and not giving up. Not giving up is so, so very important. Going ahead, Hislop says, but Swami, if one is a prisoner, that is a fact at the moment, if one observes this fact about himself, he may then develop a very deep interest in freedom. Oh, if one observes this fact about himself, he may then develop a very deep interest in freedom. So Swami is speaking about you freeing yourself of all the vasanas and everything. So Hislop is saying, Swami, just noticing the fact that I'm a prisoner,
right,
will that not egg me to go towards freedom? This is easily understandable and relatable, because I think a dozen movies have made every year on this theme, where there's a prisoner and he's thinking of how to break out. Every prisoner wants to break out of prison. So Hislop is saying, when man also realizes that he's a prisoner, won't that itself egg him on towards freedom?
Right. I think more than, we'll probably finish Swami's answer and then we'll discuss. Swami says, very few people have these deep levels of self-inquiry. As yet, they have not gone deeply into the matter. Rightness is a factor here. In talks with devotees, these aspects of sadhana should be brought forward and their importance indicated by your own experience. So this is the part I was mentioning before. Swami was saying that this does not come naturally. It is something that comes over a period of time, as you were also mentioning, that doing the acts of goodness will eventually lead you to that self-inquiry of the source of the goodness itself, or what is the basis on which that idea of goodness comes. But Swami is saying that this does not come naturally for most devotees. It has to be spoken of. And especially Hislop, he is saying that from your experience, you should speak about it.
You know, going to this prisoner example, as I said, the minute you know that you are bound, you will want freedom. But just imagine if you're a prisoner who doesn't know you're in prison.
Right.
I think that is the state most of
us
are in.
I was about to say that, because when you talk of a prisoner, invariably the idea of a prison itself is for self-correction. You know, you're being told that you're being condemned to be in prison, and what is our state is what generally they speak about. You know, the indoctrination that happens through media, for instance, right? You've been, especially the advertisements that you see, or you've been told constantly that, you know, this is how you should lead your life. And without our knowledge, we're actually being imprisoned in that.
And we don't know.
Right? And if you really go into, you know, who is the person who is running the media, who is the person who is running the news, you will find that it's a whole network that is being created so that you're being made to think in a certain way. And the moment you start thinking of that, you realize that actually I'm being imprisoned in an ideology which I might not be in if I was aware that I'm being imprisoned in.
Absolutely.
Right? And that's required, that knowledge is required for you to break free from that.
It's like they say, we don't know. And we don't know that we don't know.
Right.
That is the state we are in. So Swami says that your destiny is actually a sum total of all your actions in your life. I mean, I'm just summarizing this whole discussion we had. Your destiny is nothing but a sum total of all your actions. And since your actions have constituted destiny, your actions can also modify and change destiny. But that modification and change will not happen overnight. So there's no need to get disheartened, like changing the course of a ship. It'll take time, but it will happen. And then Hislop says, with this regard, he goes to emotions. But I think before we go to that, we'll take a quick little break, dear listeners. And on the other side of the break, we'll continue with the discussion.
Thank you.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are in the middle of a very interesting conversation. It started off with self-inquiry, and Swami, then the conversation went into how much one is able to transform oneself, how much freedom one has, how much one is dictated by one's nature, and that was the point that we took a break in. Now, Hislop goes on to ask another important question, which is a continuation of the same conversation. Hislop says, one observes many emotions in himself. Swami, some are damaging too, such as anger, hatred, jealousy, depression, fear, and so on. These are very strong and they come up despite one's best intentions. And Swami replies, this is a very important topic. It is important in America where emotions are strong and lead to violent action. Then Hislop says, there seems to be a possibility, Swami, that a person can curb these dangerous emotions from going on into action. And Swami says, the problem is that people have some knowledge from books, but they do not have the general knowledge of life that comes with spiritual power. With discipline, prayer to God, and steady sadhana, there is a spiritual power which comes up within the person and the strength of dangerous emotions is reduced. But even apart from that, people can and should try to restrain these harmful emotions from outward expression. There may be anger, hatred, depression raging within, but the person's outward behavior should remain peaceful. His smile should be calm. With all this strength, he must resist any show of these harmful emotions. This is a topic of the highest importance. Self-inquiry and this matter of emotions are of the greatest importance. When talking to devotees at centers, you must deal with these two aspects of spiritual sadhana clearly and emphatically. I think in that one passage, Swami is saying it is important three or four times, and that shows.
See, I think the confusion that can possibly arise here, because I had also felt this confusion once, is, see, when we read this autobiography of a yogi, there's this experience that Paramahamsa Yogananda records, wherein he's sitting for meditation and there's a mosquito that's bothering him, it's biting him, and he gets so irritated with the mosquito, he just wants to kill that mosquito, but he's sitting without doing that, without killing the mosquito. And the Guruji comes and tells him, his guru, who's Yukteswar Giri, comes and tells him, Mukunda, what are you trying to do? He says, Guruji, I'm trying to meditate. He's saying, by killing a mosquito? He says, where have I killed a mosquito? I didn't kill. He says, your hand can as well finish off the deed that your mind has already committed. And then Yukteswar Giri explains to him that even mentally when you kill a mosquito, it's as good as you're killing the mosquito. We also have the experience of Brother Indreshwar, wherein he is so upset with a person who is cheating his family that sitting in darshan, he is closing his eyes and, you know, punching the life out of that person mentally, because he is feeling so helpless that he can't do anything physically. Swami comes running out and tells, stop, what are you doing? Why are you killing him? So it shows that mentally when you commit something, it's as good as it being committed physically. So it might lead me to think that, you know, somebody irritated me, I got so angry. So when I've got so angry and I've already slapped him mentally, I as well slap him off. You know, it's like when I'm suffering the negative karma of getting angry on him, but I as well enjoy the satisfaction of actually slapping him, right? But, you know, I think all these experiences, whether it is Brother Indreshwar's or even Paramahamsa Yogananda's, it is applicable after you have achieved some sort of control on physical expression. See, when you first refrain from expressing your anger physically, then you move to the stage of trying to stop the anger from arising in you only. That doesn't mean the reverse. You know, it doesn't mean that it doesn't give you license that if you get angry mentally, go and slap. If you got lust arising in your mind, go ahead and commit heinous acts. No, it doesn't mean that. It just means that at the first level, you have to stop yourself from physically expressing it. Swami says it's very important. And that's why Swami says, especially in America, but because I think, you know, when you look at all these shootings and all happening in schools. So Swami is saying, even if you get angry, upset, it's okay. Stop from expressing. Now, having reached the level wherein you get angry at a mental level or you get agitated, you feel lust, you feel jealousy at a mental level, but you're not expressing it, then you start moving towards stopping it from arising. Because it arising in your mind is as good as you committing it physically. So it's a next level. It should not be confused in the other way, saying that now it has anyway arisen, anyway I've got the karma of it, I may as well do it. No. Swami clearly says that the first step is to prevent doing whatever comes in your mind. Put a filter, put a discrimination filter, don't put it into action, even if it comes in your thought and word level. Then possibly stop it from coming even into your word level, then start working on stopping it from arising in the thought level.
And when Swami says it's a very important topic in America, I think this probably is in the late 70s, early 80s probably. And what Swami is saying here, I think, is applicable to many, many modern societies. Because I think when Swami says America, it is in places where there is more freedom, unrestrained expression can be more dangerous. Right? We see that in America, as you rightly said. You know, you have the freedom to have firearms. Then the way you express is, I mean, you have not mastered the way of, you know, controlling your mind, and you've been given the freedom in this manner. Comparing it to our own childhood, you know, we could get extremely angry with our parents, but the expression was very limited because of the culture itself. There's only a certain amount you can talk back. There's only a certain amount you can, you know, probably walk out of that room.
And raising your hand was unimaginable.
Raising your voice itself was unimaginable, right? So the culture itself has a certain amount of restraint on the expression also. The more freedom there is in the culture, I think the more important this topic is. As I think I mentioned this before, one of the former students who was in the armed forces, I think he was in the Air Force, if I'm not wrong. So he was once telling this, you know, in the army, when you're being trained to be a soldier or in any of the defense forces, you will be given a firearm much later, you know, probably about 6 months or 5 months after your training, you will be given a firearm. And even that firearm probably will not be the firearm which can harm somebody. It'll be a firearm which is meant to, you know, train. Finally, when you're given a firearm which can actually kill a person, that'll be after you're properly trained, you're in a state where you're ready to follow orders. But you would say that the same firearm, if you go into a terrorist organization, it'll be given in the second or third day, right? Because there, you're being given a firearm to be used. Here you're being given a firearm and you're trained not to use it.
Wow.
Right? And says that that requires more training. And I think that's what we're talking about in societies where there's more freedom, more emphasis has to be given on how to restrain. And it's a very important point that you said. It's two different levels that we're talking about. And we always tend to mix up this. In the name of being unity of thought, word, and deed, and being an open person, we think that what I think, I have to speak it out. And very beautifully, Swami is saying that, you know, if you have a bad thought, the first thing is ensure that it doesn't come in physical, because the way you will repent after it has been expressed in the physical thought is going to be much, much more. And you can always work it out in your mind than having done the act and then having to face the consequences of that act. I think that's a very important point that Swami is making here. And
it's almost like the difference between living with a guilty feeling and living with guilt. You know, right. If it's only in your mind, it's only a guilty feeling. If it actually gets expressed, it becomes a true guilt because you've done a bad deed. You know, if we can modify what Superman would say, it would be with great freedom comes great responsibility.
Right.
You know, there are one or two movies which are made again on a concept wherein suddenly a human being is made to be God for a while. You know, and we all think also, if you're God, it's so cool, you can get whatever you can. When as kids, when we think if you're God, what we'll do, we'll think of going to the places we like, we think of, you know, changing everything how we want. That's precisely the reason we can't be God, because we don't have the responsibility that comes with the absolute power and absolute freedom that God has. And when we look at Swami, for instance, I mean, the amount of rules that he adhered to, why? you know, when it came to matters of the trust or anything also, never Swami said, if this is a government law, like, you know, you blatantly know that in spirit, this is what Swami is saying is right. He's the avatar. It is right. But yet, Swami would stick to the state laws, the district laws, to everything. He adhered to it. Why? And you wonder why, Swami, that person, you are so powerful, you can change the universe. No. Because with great freedom comes great responsibility, and my life is my message. Swami's life is his message. We can see his life and realize what a restrained and constrained life he has led throughout. You know, like that example was so beautiful when you say that you're trained how not to use it. It's almost like God comes with all the powers and with the training how not to use it, how not to misuse it or abuse it. It's used absolutely when necessary and in a manner that benefits most, not even benefiting him. So, very right that...
And the other important point in that passage, I think, which needs to be emphasized is Swami's talking of the importance of prayer to God, steady sadhana. Swami says there is a spiritual power which comes up within this. I think this is something that Swami has told many, many people. A lot of, I mean, even in our own family, if you have these elders who have given themselves to a lot of prayer, like my grandmother, she always used to have a book in her hand. Mm. And a few minutes, if you leave her alone, she'll go back to that book. I think it was some Ashtotram or some Lalita Sahasranamam or something like that. So you'd find a lot of these elders had this. And take one look at their lives. It was 10 times more, they had seen more hardships than any of us. But the equanimity with which they were able to bear it, I don't think today's generation has that kind of a patience, has that kind of tenacity also. And that comes with this regular prayer that they all do. And Swami would say this, any prayer, right? Just chanting some mantra or Gayatri mantra or something. Because Swami would say this, I think especially during Dashara, Swami would say that. The word Swami would use is Icha Shakti.
Mm.
You know, you all can be informed. You can have the Jnana Shakti, right? You've been informed that this is the right thing to do. But you should be having the Icha Shakti and Kriya Shakti to follow that. The will to follow that, and that comes with all of these things, leading a disciplined life, chanting all these mantras, because whether we understand or not, these purify the mind in a certain manner and give you a power which cannot be ever overstated.
And also, Prem, I feel like when you chant the name of God, when you think of the form of God, you start growing in love for it. The mind is made in such a way that what it thinks of most, it gets attached to. You know, and that is a power. In fact, that is the reason also, taking it to an extreme, extrapolating it extremely, we see that people like Kamsa, Shishupala, who condemned and wanted to kill Lord Krishna, they got liberated. Because it is said that all said and done, they did Ninda Stuti. They have done bhakti by thinking of me. Irrespective of how they have thought, by thinking of me, they become, you know, they become deserving of that. That is the power of... That is the power of, I think, thinking of the Lord's name, doing Namasmarana, doing Japa. And in fact, Hislop makes a little note here, which also in a way emphasizes what we just discussed. Hislop writes, on previous occasions, Swami has said that dangerous and harmful impulses and emotions will vanish automatically in the presence of God. The evil forces are products of grief and cannot exist where there is Ananda. The happiness that arises when one loves God with all of one's heart and sees Him everywhere. So, you know, when we do these, see, for instance, I'm sure if you ask yourself or if I ask myself, we'll say that the Lord we love the most is Swami. Because apart from what Swami has done to us, we also, whenever we get an opportunity, whenever we think of God, whenever we want to do Nama Japa, it is Swami only. A kind of love automatically develops to that name and form of the Lord. And when that love comes, Swami says, where love is, fear cannot reside. Where love is, all the other negative traits cannot reside. So, Hislop is also bringing up this point that, because it's related to Kama, Krodha, Lobha, which he referred to, that it's rampant in America. He's saying that when we also have bhakti towards God, automatically these go away. And now we see the beautiful synthesis. It started off with self-inquiry. And for all that, you need to keep away from Kama, Krodha, Lobha, Moha. And in order to keep away from that, here it is. If you have devotion, automatically you are kept away. So we see how each of these, Karma Marga, Bhakti Marga and Jnana Marga, reinforce each other. And they are not to be considered in isolation of the other.
Right. And underlying all of this, of course, Swami says is that sadhana also. That this is what literally, you know, keeps everything together. You have devotion, but you have to find a way of expressing that. One part of it expresses as sadhana, the other part of it expresses as inquiry. And the sadhana also strengthens your ability to stick to the right path. And it's a very beautiful way in which each, helps you follow the other. Then Hislop goes on to ask, another puzzling thing that may be observed is the falling away from one's goal. For example, a person may show the most steadfast determination to hold to the lotus feet of the Lord. Then a year or so later, that person has left Swami. Swami responds, the reason for this is a weakness of mind in the initial stage. In the first perception of his goal, the person's mind was wavering. Had he been one-pointed and clear at first, he would not fall away from his goal. The fault lies in a wavering mind that is lacking in one-pointedness.
It makes so much sense, right? Because we see this not just with Swami. Somebody decides, I want to be a doctor, midway changes. Somebody decides that I want to marry this person, midway changes. Day-to-day decisions. You know, you go to a restaurant, you want to order something and you say, hey, no, do get this. So, in any decision in our life, if we don't have that one-pointedness in the initial stage, it is very natural that we give up. And that's what Swami is saying also, that in the beginning when there is weakness and there is no one-pointedness, it's not surprising that 1 year down the line, having been with Swami, you leave Swami.
And this is also the, you know, outcome of a nature. Like, for instance, what we've been talking about, Swami is saying, one thing, if we can say, describes a spiritual person. We mentioned this even when we were talking about the word watch, which Swami gives as an acronym. If one thing, if in one sentence you can describe what Swami says is a spiritual life, is it's a conscious life. You observe your thoughts, you consciously speak what you speak, you choose what actions you want to perform. You don't, there is not a free flow in that sense, that what I think I just blurt out, and whatever I feel like doing, I do. You consciously, you decide that this is a good action to perform, I perform it. And this is the right thing to say at this moment, I say this. When that integrity or when that conscious living is not there, I think even when you're talking about something like devotion, when you're talking about following Swami or making a commitment to stick to the spiritual path, that also becomes like a thought occurs. I say I want to be here. I will do whatever Swami tells me to do. There is no conscious commitment to that. And probably I think Swami says that is what is that lack of one-pointedness. If you're aware of this, if you're aware that you have to, there are 100 thoughts going, and this one thought, you find this with so many people. The lot of people who land up for the first time in Prashanthi Nilayam, and they say, oh, it's so peaceful, I want to be here. What can I do to come and settle here? That's not wrong. The feeling is not wrong. Many times I would see this, who wouldn't like a place like Prashanthi Nilayam? Who wouldn't fall in love with Swami? The first time you see Swami, you feel that, I need to leave everything and live the rest of my life for Swami. But you must acknowledge that there are 100 thoughts in your mind and this is just one of them. And if you really want to foster this thought, then you have to hold on to that. If you do not do that in the initial stages, then like every other whims and fancies, I think it also comes and goes. And I think that's something that you see with happening to so many people, and Swami is making a reference to that.
Yeah, I think in the Ramkatha Rasavahini also we had discussed this as the difference between emotion and devotion. Depending on the circumstances, the ambience, or what is the situation I'm coming from, something suddenly feels awesome. And I think the best test of a kind of practical test to see for myself is, for 21 days in a row, is it the same? Like the other day I was going for a walk and I put on the Radio Sai Bhajan channel and a bhajan came, and seeing Swami with that bhajan, when I'm listening to that, I was in tears. I was just weeping. It felt so awesome, so wonderful. And I felt, wow, Swami, today I got a taste of how it is to be devoted. But then what I did is, next day again I played the bhajan. Again it happened. Third day when I did it, it did feel so emotional, And I felt that, yeah, maybe this is emotion. At that point in time, possibly I was having a difficulty. Possibly I was feeling low. And the music, the ambience, the kind of, the storm was coming. Therefore, it was a little cool, cloudy. All that together created a kind of atmosphere in which I just broke down and remembered Swami. if it is true devotion, if it is that, then it should be able to recreate that every time. You know, the next time, even though there is a cool atmosphere, even though the same music I'm listening, same video I'm watching, why am I not responding in that manner? That is where, you know, because as you rightly said, in my mind there are 100 thoughts, and this is the predominant thought, and that's why I felt it. Next time when there is some other thought which is the predominant thought, this is totally lost. So when there is some other thought which becomes a predominant thought, I might actually give up what was a predominant thought a few days back or possibly an year back. And that's why we even give up Swami.
Right, then. So the point is that it is not that if you happen to come to Prashanthi and you feel that way, don't remember this satsang and say that, oh, it's a wrong thing to feel. But it has to be fostered. I think that's the most important thing. You know, Swami would say, every seed has immense potential, but it needs to be given the right kind of a soil. It needs to be given the right kind of attention. At different stages, different things are required. Same way, I think, a simple thought like, you know, I want to lead a spiritual life. I want to lead my life the way Swami wants it to be done. Swami would say it's like a sapling. It needs discipline as a fence around it. It needs attention. It needs different nutrients at different times. And that needs to be given that due attention. It is not, I've had a thought, well, it's a pure thought, and now it is Swami's duty to ensure that it, you know, finds its fulfillment. That's not how it works.
Exactly. When we were in our school and college days, in the summer course, one of the themes that was a kind of favorite for different speakers to speak on was, be clear, the rest shall follow. So I also think in light of what we have discussed, it's like when I get a thought which I feel is pure and beautiful and I felt wonderful, I think you have to be clear that that is now the main thought. Clear away the rest. Because a point in time will come when you feel possibly money is the most important, or possibly you'll go to Italy or you'll go to Rome and you feel that, you know, this is, I think, my dream place where who would not want to be. Because the way I felt in Prashanthi that this is where I want to stay, I'll feel the same when I go to Rome possibly, I'll feel the same when I go to Australia possibly, I'll feel the same possibly if I go to any other city in India. It may be like that. So at that point in time, it's important to be clear. And I think, and after that, once we are clear, the rest shall follow, meaning once we are very clear at the thought
actions,
level,
right.
Yes, the words and decisions and actions will follow. After this, you know, a very, very interesting question Hislop asks. Hislop says, Swami, one more question, please, about household pests. The housewife is in constant battle with ants, mosquitoes, cockroaches, etc. Unless she fights, these insects take over home. Swami says, it's all right. They must be dealt with. People are afraid that they are, Hislop says, people are afraid they may be committing a sin against Swami if they kill these small creatures. And Swami says, there's nothing wrong in keeping the home free from the assault of these small creatures. But only where you are, your area, not outside. Such a super practical solution, Swami gives. Yes, you have to protect your home from them, kill them, shoo them off. But do it only within the confines of your home.
Right. A lot of people have this question, and I think we've got this question many times from our listeners also.
Because, especially about cockroaches.
Right. Because once you get sensitized, you know, we might have, without sparing a thought, got rid of pests till we came to Swami. But after you come to Swami, or after you start reading spiritual books, you start reading about Buddha, you start thinking, oh God, all of this is himsa, all of this is violence, is it okay? So Swami makes it very clear. In fact, there's a huge discussion on this in Manusmriti, where there are a lot of things consciously we do. You know, there's a cockroach or a pest or a rat at home. You're kind of dealing with it. You know that I'm killing this creature. But, you know, in the Manusmriti, they say that merely by existing, you cause inconvenience to so many creatures.
Hmm.
Right? It's very easy to think of and talk of non-vegetarianism as a way by which you're harming another creature. But do we know how much inconvenience to other creatures we're creating by merely being vegetarians? Because the amount of fields that are cleared off to grow grains was actually forest area. You know, you're taking away the habitat of so many other creatures.
No, when we say even of carbon footprint.
Exactly.
That is an indirect burden that you put. Right. Only that you don't know directly your hands are getting dirty. But you are a burden.
Right. Or as they say, when you're building a house, when you're building a foundation for building a building, all of this involves you know, killing of creatures. And that is why, in fact, in Manuspriti, they say that if you're a householder, you end up doing these kind of, sins. And to negate these sins, you are expected to, Swami has also spoken about it, the five kind of yajnas that a householder does, Pitru Yajna and five yajnas. I'm not mentioning all of them, but it is there in Swami's discourse.
Panchamaha yajnas, they call it.
Right. Bhuta Yajna, which Swami says, when you're making the rangoli, the feeding of the ants that happens when you make a rangoli.
Yes, you usually do it with rava and...
Swami would often say that nowadays you put a sticker or you put some color powder which is not edible. Correct. To them, Swami would say that there are rituals that you perform which involves feeding of cows, which involves going and feeding, and Swami would say that 1/5 of everyone's salary should go to feeding animals and other creatures. So all of this is part of the scriptures, where you say that merely by me existing in a society, I am causing inconvenience to other beings. So I am trying to do my bit by, doing all of these yajnas, planting of trees or taking care of other animals, and all of these are involved in that. So Swami is making it very clear that to a certain extent, practical living is important. You know, there is no end to it. There is, at some point, you have to draw the line. So Swami is saying, you don't have to worry about dealing with pests. They have to be dealt with the way they have to be dealt with.
An interesting thought that I got was, this also indirectly shows the importance of sealing on desires. Because, as you say, our existence itself is a burden on Mother Earth. So how much ever restrained and, contented we can live with as little as possible, that much we are reducing the burden. Even extrapolating directly, whether I have a 2-bedroom house versus a 5-bedroom house or a single bedroom house, proportionally the number of pests and insects are going to rise.
Right.
So when I have a 10-bedroom house, I'll be killing a lot more than when I have a 1-bedroom house or something like that. So
right, and probably extending that thought, as Swami would say, that when you're born through a mother's womb, you are in immense debt to that one person, because you're putting one individual through so much pain. And the highest level of gratitude that you can pay to that mother is to ensure that you don't come back again and trouble another mother. And I think that can be extended even to Mother Earth, right?
Yes.
Even as we are, we can't help it at this point, we are causing some kind of inconvenience, not some kind, immense inconvenience to Mother Earth. But at the same time, the spiritual sadhana that you do is trying to ensure that, can I ensure that I don't come back again and put Mother Earth through the same inconvenience?
Prem, we are in these situations of a lockdown, and the maid servant who would come home and do the cleaning, and she's not coming. So basically that job has landed on some of us in the home only.
Right.
One interesting thought that I got when I'm actually sweeping and mopping the house is, my house feels very big. It's just not ending. It takes me half an hour to finish the sweeping and mopping with water for the whole house. And I felt one practical way of seeing sealing on desires would be, have as big a house which you can mop and sweep if your maid doesn't come. you have a 10-bedroom house. Can you mop and sweep the whole place? No, you're going to keep it dirty. So I think one practical way of seeing how big house I need is how much you can mop and sweep without complaining for 1 month. Because now I'm feeling my house is possibly 20% bigger than what I can mop and sweep. So
yeah, that will be a good way of buying real estate. You go to buy a house. So can
but you know, Prem, I also got another question for which I don't have an answer. Maybe if you have an answer, or maybe our listeners can write in, it'll be interesting. When Swami says that, it's okay, you can keep the house clean. Now, in my house, I have ants as pests. I have cockroaches. I also have a rat. Now, when I kill an ant vis-a-vis a rat, vis-a-vis a cockroach, as you say, there is some sin involved, whatever. And that is the reason we do all the yajnas to wipe away. Is there a kind of degree of sin? I mean, is it less sinful to kill an ant, more sinful to kill a rat? I don't know, because, it takes a lot more effort and it feels more horrible killing a rat, honestly. Whether I catch it in a trap and kill it, or even I hit it with a broom and kill it, it feels more more sinful and more guilty than killing an ant. Ant, you hardly feel anything, you just kill it off. So I want to know whether there are different levels of sin, or if the sin is same, whether you kill an ant or a rat. I feel though I kill the rats, at my home, my parents kill the ants. There are so many ants being killed. So they must be committing 100 times more sin than what I am doing because I am just killing a rat. This was just a question that came. And interestingly, Hislop and Swami also discuss something according to this, but it doesn't give an answer to this question of mine. So I just thought I'll throw it open even to our listeners. But we shall proceed with what the question is.
So we'll just listen to what this question and answer is about, and then probably we'll discuss. Hislop then asks, Swami, if one ant out of a colony of ants is killed, is that killing an individual jiva? Or is there a sort of group jiva whose body is the colony of ants? Swami says, there are no individual jivas. Jiva is one only one. Jiva is never injured, never killed. Bodies are many. Minds are changeable and may be affected. Bodies may be killed, may die, but jiva is unaffected. Jiva is one and eternal. The rule for spiritual life is to be cautious. Start carefully, dry carefully, and arrive safely. I think it's a very, very important point that Swami is making, and I think Swami is in a way switching between, you know, being very mundane and practical, and at the same time, but this is not like Swami is doing something which is wrong or
not trying to be evasive.
Right, evasive. I think this is how one needs to deal with life itself. The mind has to be focused in the ultimate. You never lose sight of that. Because Swami would say that, you know, when you're harming another person, you're not harming another person. You're harming yourself. That is the thought you always are supposed to hold on to. So whether you're harming one ant or two ants or whether it's a rat, it is a part of yourself which you're harming. There was a movie which was coming. There's a very beautiful dialogue in that where they're talking about a weapon. You know, the protagonist is holding a weapon and the other person is asking the question, if I shoot once with this gun, will a person die? So the person says, there are two people who die when you shoot. The one who shoots and the one who's shot at.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because even the person who kills, actually a part of him dies. If you really look at it, it's a very deep thought, even mentally, you know, not talking of the spiritual connotation of that. Because every time you harm another person, a part of yourself actually dies.
Mm.
So that is why the whole idea is to be careful, to be cautious. As you rightly said, you know, take only as much as you need. If you really look at it, the indiscriminate living is the most dangerous thing. To be conscious, to be cautious. As we have many times spoken about when we spoke about topics related to the environment. It is only that. It is just that conscious living that is what is important.
And again, you know, before we conclude today's satsang, we'll just read out a little note that Hislop makes. Because I think at this point in time, the interview or the session gets over and a new session begins. Hislop makes a note here that on a previous occasion, Swami said, be steady, be resolved. Do not commit a fault or take a false step and then repent. Have the deliberation, the decision, the discipline first. That is better than regret for the mistake made. I think Swami would often tell it in his discourses that purvatapam is more important than paschatapam.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that. And that also would be a distinction Swami would make between Arjuna and Duryodhana. We discussed it before.
Arjuna and Yudhishthira, in fact. Swami would say among the Pandavas, even though all of them were great, why Arjuna was picked up? And Swami would say that Yudhishthira repented after the war.
He had paschatapam.
Arjuna
had purvatapam where he felt bad even before committing.
Right.
He thought about it and then did it. And yeah, paschatapa, not, I think yes, everybody has paschatapa. When we do something wrong, we repent for it later. Swami says a spiritual aspirant must go through that before in the mind, and having resolved it and having been clear about it, then only go ahead with the action, because then after that you won't have repentance, because it's an action that is committed with forethought and foresight. On that note, dear listeners, we will conclude this afternoon's satsang. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed it. And once again, we are so thrilled with this beautiful little way in which Swami sent his shower of love and blessings through this cool air from this air conditioner over here. Just as we thought that it would be a difficult satsang to do, Swami in an instant transformed everything. And I think in these troubled times, these difficult times, this is a message that we should always hold on to, that however dark be the night, however tough be the situation, all it needs for the Lord to change it is just one moment. And we have to wait in anticipation for that moment. We need not think that the night has been so long for hours and it will take hours more for it to get resolved. It's not like that. As Swami would say, to put on the switch, it takes just one moment. And the darkness that has lasted for years gets cleared. So also, however difficult our situation, whatever be that is troubling us, let's hold on, let's have faith, let's know that when Swami decides, it's just a matter of the moment, and He will decide at the right moment. Thank you, dear listeners. You can write to us with your thoughts, your feedback, your anything that you would like to share at listener@radioside.org. We will end now with a song, on the other side of which, as always, you will be joined by Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love.
Thank you. daya.